Hello everyone and welcome to Don't Ignore the Elephant, the podcast where we talk about the stuff that no one else will, the elephant in the room. I'm Liz O'Riordan. I'm a breast cancer surgeon with breast cancer myself, and during my career I've had a lot of elephants to deal with. I've learned that talking about them, getting them out in the open, can help you know that you're not alone. And it's wonderful that we're building a community of people who want to talk about their elephants. Keep sharing them with me, because together we can help each other. Whether it's cancer, grief, resilience or bullying, losing your identity, or simply how to get out of bed in the morning, there are loads of things that can be hard to discuss. I know how powerful it can be to hear someone else talk honestly about their own problems. I've carefully chosen my guests to help get these issues on the table. They've either experienced the elephant themselves or spent their life helping those of us who have them. I'm going to be asking the questions everyone else is too afraid to ask. In this episode, we really will prove that age is just a number, as my guest talks about cancer, crafting, and how to look cool in your 70s. Ingrid Bergman said that getting old is like climbing a mountain. You get a little out of breath, but the view is much better. Now, I was always scared of getting old. I imagined I'd spend my later years dressed in sensible clothes and even worse, sensible shoes, because that's what older ladies were meant to do. Now, this week's guest has well and truly shown that age is just a number. You can reinvent yourself when life knocks you back. You can run a successful business well past retirement age and look cool whilst doing it. Debbie Bliss has done it all. And not only that, she made knitting cool years before Tom Daley came along. I'm a huge fan, and it's going to be hard to control my inner fangirl. So welcome, Debbie, to Don't Ignore the Elephant.
Oh, hi. And also, I think I was just saying to you a bit earlier that I was so worried I was going to gush about you because you are my hero.
Oh, don't say that. It's funny how two people come together, isn't it? Now, for those of my listeners who've never picked up a pair of knitting needles in their life, they might not know who you are. But to me, you've been the face of knitting for as long as I can remember. How did it all start?
It started, actually, it was when I was at, I did fashion and textiles at art college, must have been back, probably about 1970, and I realised I was really, really bad at pattern cutting.
No! So
I'd cut, oh my God, I don't understand. And so I wandered off into another of the studios and I saw a knitting machine and I realised that actually I could handle that a lot better. And then when I left, it was a time of quite innovative things in craft. One of my favourite people were Klaus Oldenburg, who was a sculptor who did, probably not a very good thing to mention now, but he did actually do a cigarette in an ashtray made out of, I think it was plastic or fabric. A massive sculpture, I think it was in Central Park. And so this idea of soft sculpture came about, and that trickled down to craft areas as well. And then I started making knitted plants, and then I sold them. Yeah, I did a range in Liberty. They had a one-off gallery at the time, and I sold a Lurex cheese plant to Elton John.
No and way. So I need the pattern for that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure I could whip something up for you, Liz. And then through having some publicity about that, that's when magazines started contacting me about doing hand-knit designs for them. Mm-hmm. And actually, I hadn't hand-knitted probably for years. In fact, I'm not entirely sure I ever had. So I went back. And also, in my panic about going into the magazines, I'd presented so many swatches and ideas. And sadly, this particular magazine picked the most complicated one. So I went back home and Mum just fed me lots of cups of tea while I tried to find out how to do intarsia colour work.
Oh my goodness.
So that was the first one. And then through working on magazines, I was contacted by Good House King, a wonderful fashion editor at the time, Angela Kennedy, who asked me to edit a couple of Good Housekeeping books, knitting books. Mm-hmm. And then through that, I was contacted by publishers to do a knitting book. And at the time, it was, I think I just had Bill, who's 37 now. And so mm-hmm. I was particularly interested in baby knits. And that was the first book that I did. And like a lot of things in life, I'm sure you will find too, Liz, is that sometimes it's just one little chance thing that makes yeah. your life change. So with this, apparently the sales rep said, oh, nobody knits for babies. Nobody knits these days. My wife says nobody knits. And the editor went, you know what? I'm going to go against the general opinion here and commissioned the book. So, yeah, wow. That was really life-changing for me.
And was that back in the 90s? When was that, the 1970s?
Well, I'm trying to think. That would have been early 80s.
Yeah.
And it was really good in the at that time, it was very simple knits on big needles, you know, a couple of squares for the back and front and a yeah. couple of rectangles for the sleeve. So it was a lot easier for me to get into it because, as I say, the patterns were so basic. But in the things that I knitted for myself were from my old 1940s, 1930s books, uh-huh. Whether the shaping was very intricate. So I think that's really how I learnt my trade, through that.
And do you knit for pleasure and then you had knitting for business, or was it all kind of work?
I think my first passion was design, and it just so happened that I found an area of design at the time, I didn't necessarily have a passion for hand knitting. That came later when I realised all the things that you could do. I mean, apart from anything else, because I've been doing the plants and ready to wear. I used to sell off stores and, you know, mm-hmm. I was always trying to think of other small businesses I could do, even when I was a student. But the fear, for anyone that's a machine knitter out there, the fear as the carriage goes across that it's going to fall off was too much. It bred too much anxiety in me. Then I realised with hand knitting, this was glorious. You could put together different patterns and different textures, and it was just wonderful. It just opened up a whole new area of design to me.
I guess being able to create a fabric and see it grow and make something that fits you. But I say that, I used to knit like I used to operate. So I was a surgeon, so all my knots have to be really tight so they hold and there's no leakage of blood and bowel.
Yes.
And I remember I had, my mum taught me to knit years ago. I had one of those French dollies and it kind of grew from there.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
When the Scandi drama The Killing came out, those Norwegian jumpers yeah. were everywhere. I thought, I'm going to knit The Killing jumper. And I ordered... I ordered the wool and it smelt like a horse. It was really, really rough, like Icelandic wool. And I knitted this jumper and it would fit a 12-year-old flat-chested girl. My knitting was so tight. And then when I operate, I get to go away and let the juniors finish up the wounds and make it look pretty. And I need that for my knitting. I need a fairy to come along and thread in all the ends and sew it up.
Yeah. I remember I used to have a shop years ago mm-hmm. In London, and it had lots of little things. It had a bit of yarn, it had some books, it had children's clothes. But I used to do workshops at a weekend, and perhaps 10 people had come. I could guarantee at least 6 of those would be nurses that worked in A&E.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, it was just like they found knitting so relaxing. But I have to say that I always would gauge by about 4 o'clock, they'd tell the most appalling stories.
Yes.
In fact, they would just end up helpless with laughter. It was
yeah.
just...
You get very good at clearing a restaurant very, very quickly when you get a group of medics together.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas I, of course, would have just come and joined you. Oh. And God, I know you don't know me. God, you've got some fascinating stories.
Now, one thing I wanted to talk about, when I first started knitting, it was the classic family cheesy photographs of men on beach wearing crocheted garments looking, yes. and they weren't inspiring at all. How did you break away from that mould and start changing how we advertise knitting patterns?
I think that I was very lucky to, my first books were for, it was Ebury Press at the time. And so, I was able to choose wonderful photographers, have a stylist working on the books as well. So it was really encouraging. And I feel that at that time, things were beginning to change anyway. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the things that I found made things quite difficult for knitters was that I remember when I first went to America for work, and this was... And I was doing some workshops out there, and I went into, you know, yarn shops, and I'd go, oh, I say, you can get blends and mixtures that like silk with some wool or mm-hmm. alpaca with something. Whereas back home at the time, you know, a blend would be could be 80% wool, 20% nylon.
Yes.
So it kind of, it introduced this whole new world and exciting world of the fibres that were available. And I also remember going around stores, and it was so different than from UK at the time. They'd have tables where people could sit round. I remember thinking, this is amazing, because I'd sit in on some of those, and women were talking about smear tests and things like that. What I think in America had been created is a place that people could come together. They were in knitting groups. They were exchanging ideas, talking about women's health. If there was somebody there that was a beginner, they could help them, because otherwise you could feel quite isolated.
Yeah.
And then when I came back, I thought, God, that's amazing. And so I think after that, stores started changing. I think people opened up yarn shops that also had those things there. It became a community. And I think I can remember thinking just before that I was meeting people whose mothers didn't knit, but whose grandmothers knitted. And I think, oh my goodness, there's a whole generation missing. Is it going to die out?
Yeah.
And what was so wonderful about the younger generation taking it up is that they came to it as such a fresh thing. They were kind of demanding beautiful yarns. They weren't.
Yeah.
They knew they'd perhaps have to pay a little bit more for it, but they wanted something that would last and but would show that they cared. And if they were spending hours to do something. So I think that I was just a bit before that, but was really excited by the change that was happening. And then I think on magazines at the same time, the kind of old guard, if you like, of knitting editors were leaving. And so you got younger ones who were then, wanted to make sure that the knits looked lovely. They wanted to give it a kind of fashion look. They wanted to make the knits really appealing. So I think that things have changed.
For the next generation.
Mm.
But your business, it hasn't all been a success, has it?
About four years ago, my distributor became insolvent. So because of that, the whole business crashed.
God. I was lucky. How old were you at the time, Debbie?
Well, let me think. I started up the yarn line started when I was 47.
Mm-hmm.
And that was I was very lucky then, because I would never, ever have had the money to do that myself. So there was a distributor that started up in the UK at the same time. So I was able to do all the things that I love, being involved in yarn choices, doing the designs myself, coming up with the collection. So doing all the lovely creative side without having to worry about warehousing and buying the yarn. And so I was 47 then, and then I'll be 70 next month. So then that was going for 20 odd years. And then I say in 2018, that's when perhaps at the end of 2017, it all went pear-shaped. So that was everything, sort of everything was lost then. I tried to find someone that could buy the company, because it got to the point where, because I lost a lot of money through it, where we were having to probably sell the house. And also in order to sell your company, you have to obviously involve lawyers and business managers and things
like
that.
Free.
So, so it got to a point where the outgoing was tremendous in order to sell, but then I couldn't find a buyer. And then I was really lucky in that Lovecrafts came along and bought the brand. Then an online company, but they're a really exciting company to work with. So for the last, what would it be, four or five years, I've been working with them. Contractually, it was, to stay around for 3 years just to oversee the brand.
Yeah.
But actually, after that, I loved it so much there anyway. And I just thought, I can't. People just say, oh, aren't you retired yet?
I was about to ask that. I mean, come on now. You're well past the age.
And I forget, I do think actually that in the design area, it's easier to be, I can go, well, Vivian Westwood, she's no spring chicken.
No.
It's easier because it shouldn't affect your designs. I think that if you You're aware of trends. If you research, if you take it really seriously, if you go to exhibitions, then that's part of the job that you do. So that,
yeah.
But also, I'm aware of the fact that there are some really young, exciting, next generation knitwear designers that have come along. And I think, you know, I don't want to hog the limelight, because I was really, really lucky in so many ways.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine. I am going part time now. I'm going to do 3 days, okay, rather than the five. But it's such a passion. But I also work with lovely people.
What's it like being the oldest woman in the building? Do you get treated as the granny or the agony aunt? Do they all come to you with ever for advice?
Well, I think I'd probably force it on them. It's like, if they don't want that, I'm just going, hang on a minute. No, it's...
Let me sort your love life out. Come on here, sit down.
It was... We used to be in a WeWorks, and that's when I realised that I'd work into the entrance, that I wasn't only the oldest person in the company, I was the oldest person in the whole thing. I've realised, I think, as you have, Liz, that a pair of statement glasses can take you a long way.
Yes, so we're going to come on to that later.
Yeah.
But now, your business isn't the only setback that you've had, because like me, you've had a mastectomy. Mm. Can you tell us all a little bit about that?
Yes, so actually, it was a bit of a... Yeah, it was a strange... Well, it was a year of changes, that's for sure, 2018. So I sold the business in April and joined Lovecraft in April 2018. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that year, in December, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So the following year, I had... It's one of those things where I think this happens with some people. At the beginning, it all seemed very, oh, you know, not too bad. We'll get through this. It was going to be a lumpectomy. It was very tiny. But then as time went on and more biopsies were done, it realised that actually it was much bigger than they thought, and it was going to be a mastectomy. But even that was quite strange, because the consultant that told me obviously felt slightly embarrassed and went, so I think we could, well, we might need to take more flesh away. And I was going, oh, do you mean a mastectomy? Oh. The look of relief on his face. I just thought, I'm going to have to help him out here.
Oh, that's awful.
And then, yes, so I had the mastectomy. They found out that it was even bigger than they thought. Mm-hmm. Then it had gone into one of the lymph nodes. Well, at that point, it had gone into one of the three that I think they take away.
Yeah.
And then, so I had, was it lymphadectomy or?
Yeah, your lymph nodes removed. Yeah.
Is it the harvesting, they call it?
Some people do.
I always find that really, I don't know, creepy phrase. I don't know. I just imagine some little machine going up and, you know, like a little wheat machine or. And then I was very lucky. There was nothing in any of that. But what also, and then I had chemo, and then I had radiotherapy.
The full works.
Yeah. But during the, when they did all the scans, they found out that I had an enlarged thymus, the gland in your chest. Mm. And they said, it probably means nothing. Usually it shrinks when you're a teenager. It's only a 5% chance that it's cancer. So we'll do the chemo first. We'll have to take it out.
Yeah.
And then so after radiotherapy, they took it out and it was cancer.
Oh, God.
Because I decided I could just could be incredibly rare.
Yes, special.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, as my son would say, oh, we know we're in trouble when you put your bright voice on. we're going to a hotel. This room's cozy, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's small, but it's cozy. Oh, here she goes. She's got a bright voice on. It wasn't that the breast cancer had metastasized, which is what they thought. Mm. It wasn't that. It was two different separate cancers
at the same time.
Yeah. So that had to come out, and I'll be having scans, MRI scans, every year for 10 years for that. And also, as the lovely, lovely female consultant, a surgeon, you'll be pleased to know, said to me, she said, you know what, if you hadn't had breast cancer, we wouldn't have found the thymus cancer. So that's the way I look at it.
Yeah. And you kind of, you just have to go through it, don't you?
Yeah, you do. In a way, I think that I went into more of a black hole after the thymus cancer.
Yeah.
Than I did with the breast cancer. I mean, obviously, being diagnosed with the breast cancer and that whole journey was awful. But I'd always felt I was going to get it. I'd always felt that. I'd always had calcification, lots of, you know, there were always cysts coming off, always. Yeah,
you had busy breasts.
Yeah, yeah. They were just like really, really busy. As one radiographer said, your breasts are a nightmare.
Like, thank you very
terribly
much.
Terribly rude. Very rude.
Oh, God, the things people say.
I know. But also, bless her, I remember this from years ago. She went out and then she came back and went, oh, good luck, and gave me a thumbs up.
No.
And I thought, I'm dying.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm obviously dying. And in fact, I wasn't. That was years before I was diagnosed. Yeah. But yes, for some reason, I think that was, oh, I've come to the end of this awful year. And now there's this as well. And I just made me feel quite cancery.
And was it harder because breast cancer is everywhere? There's support, there's books, there's information, it's everywhere. But
yes,
thymus cancer is so rare.
Yeah.
Where do you go to find one other person to talk to about what
I
you're
know,
feeling?
And actually, I could have Googled it, but I decided not to because I know that... When I first was, I'd go to Barts, I'd go up to the breast cancer oncology, mm-hmm. and then I'd nip down and have an appointment with chest and thoracic department.
Yeah.
And I can remember then very tactlessly, the young doctor I saw there when I just had the mastectomy said, you know, well, the thing, if it is thymus cancer, it spreads everywhere and there's nothing
nice
you can do about it. And
oh,
I just started crying.
Jesus.
And she I did actually mention that to the lovely consultant and she said, I'm going to have a word with her.
Yeah.
So I decided not to Google it in case it was something horrible I was going to find.
Yeah.
But and then also the kind of thing sometimes where you read too much into something. When I earlier this year, I had... it was going to be the results of the scan.
Mm-hmm.
And the secretary rang up to say, oh, this lovely surgeon wants to talk to you personally.
Uh-oh.
And I just thought, oh, my God, no. Just
yeah,
kind of like just got so almost crawled up in a ball. And then the next day when she rang, she said, oh, I saw your name on the list, she said. And I thought, oh, I must have a word. See how you are.
Oh,
and the relief.
Yeah.
I think my adrenaline went through the roof. I think I almost floated. So
it's
I didn't
horrible
actually ask her the questions that I wanted to. But, I mean, she did say it can come up. It can
yeah
come back, but it's very rare. I wanted to go, rare's got my name on it.
Yeah,
so
that's me. Oh, it's just, it's such a mental roller coaster.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess after my mastectomy, I really struggled to reinvent myself. What do I wear now? My shape has changed. And after spending, you know, a year at home just wearing dog walking clothes, where was I meant to shop? And the magazines are full of 20, 30 somethings and skinny jeans and plunging necklines. And I guess you had breast cancer in your 60s. How do you reinvent yourself? How do you learn who to dress? Can you become cool again? Well, obviously we can because you are. But how hard was it for you to get used to your new shape?
Well, I've got to say that it didn't change much. I mean, after I had my mastectomy, my lovely friend came round, who, by the way, is like a senior nurse in the NHS. She looked at me and went, oh, what side did you have done?
Oh.
I went, thanks, Vindra. Thank you so much. But, and I think that it must be so much worse for people who have always had... You know, I've always been flat-chested, never liked it, but always been flat-chested. So I feel for me, it certainly didn't have an impact about sexuality and things like that, because I've always been quite, I mean, if I could have had an operation where it came up from my thighs and hips and then gave me breasts, which I think actually they can do now. And I know that the surgeon said, you know, why don't you have a... you know, reconstruction.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm in my 60s. Why would I bother? And he went, I've just done one on an 83-year-old.
Wow.
Which gave me a kind of strange image of somebody, you know, when they do pass away, lying in a coffin with these magnificent breasts.
Yes, standing proud because of the implants.
Yeah. But I thought I'd had, by then I'd had so many operations. I was so fed up with it. Yeah. I couldn't have borne to have had anything else. It had a profound impact on me in a completely different way. It was reverse, mm-hmm. I think, for most people, because I'd always been very self-conscious about how I looked and never felt attractive enough, or never felt a lot of the kind of things you might get as a teenager, I think, never really quite left me.
Yeah.
But so the impact was different. It was weird. I prepared myself quite well for things like losing my hair. I wanted to mm-hmm. be in control of everything. So I had, I bought a wig beforehand, tried it on to see how I felt in it, to get used to it. By then, before then, I'd had kind of shoulder length grey hair, and I was trying to go for a sort of like, you know, some kind of witchy hag look, which I'd yes. rather embraced at the time. Had my hair cut very short, I had it cut shorter to get used to that.
Yeah.
And then when it did start falling out, then I had it almost shaved.
Yeah.
But then I decided not to wear the wig. It was uncomfortable. It wasn't quite, it didn't feel like me.
And the hot flushes when you're dripping in sweat. The last thing you want is,
I know, all of it. I remember crying before I went to, it was a party, but it was people I didn't know very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a picture of the top of my head where I could see that it was balder than I thought. And I just had a good cry. And then I sent it to my son and daughter and my nephew's wife, who's a stylist, and it's really has amazing kind of like fashion style herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know whether to wear the wig or go like this. And they just went, you look great, but it's up to you. So I thought, right, this is going to be my introduction to going how I am.
Yeah.
And I went in and it was absolutely fine. And actually Kirsty Allsop was there.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me to be on her Christmas craft show.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, that's exposing my bald head
yes.
as much as I possibly could. I can do that. She actually also told a story about her mother had breast cancer, and she had to wear a wig, and she was at Princess Diana's funeral, and she had to wear a hat and the wig on a very hot day.
Oh, gosh.
So she understood. So
yeah.
that was another way of thinking, okay, well, I go on it. It will just be after the full chemo. So that was something I did, you know, the TV lights bouncing off my bald pate. But I thought, God, if I can walk into pubs, if I can, and people did stare, but
it
wasn't always, I mean, I would have done, to be honest, I can't really knock it. What I did find difficult is that when I first had my head, no, it wasn't shaved exactly, but as short as you could go.
Yeah.
And I remember it was my son's birthday, and I remember we were walking, and I was going, I was so self-conscious, and I was going, do you think, you know, like people just look at me and think, oh, no, oh, bless her.
Yeah.
She's got cancer. He said, no, you just look great. No, it's very stylish, Mum. We go into this restaurant, and there's it was a calf in a crypt. There was this guy sitting behind us who kept shouting out, you're so brave. You're so brave. I mean, bless him, he meant well, but of course he actually ticked every box.
Yes.
And another friend of mine who had breast cancer, who said that, you know, she went to a lot of trouble one day to kind of wrap her scarf around her head in a great way, and she got a makeup. Yeah. She looked fantastic.
Yeah.
Sitting outside having a coffee, a woman came up and said, oh, you're so brave.
Oh.
And she said, oh, my God.
I hate that word.
There was her thinking she looked great.
Yes.
I know. I'm not a great. I don't like warriors. I don't like brave.
No,
you know, it's like none of that. You just have to get through it. We don't have a choice.
We don't. It's like, well done you for going out in public with cancer. Seriously?
Ooh.
So it's funny. The guy in my post office thought that I had just shaved my head for charity because he only saw me when I was well.
Oh.
The thing, I styled my way through it with crazy glasses. Mm. I thought, if people are going to stare at me, I want them to stare at me because I look awesome.
Look great, yeah.
And it's that kind of learning to accessorize while I'm having a wobbly moment. I know I've always got the bit of blue in the hair or the glasses, and that's kind
of
You kind of find a new style and a new way of looking cool.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that changed the most about me was that, as with a lot of people, you get the chemo curl. So, it's been brilliant. I mean, that has been, and I say this seriously, life-changing, because all my life I'd had really unpleasant hair, I would say.
Yep.
It's slightly waves, but not enough to be interesting. But it'd be, and I'd have it blow-dried in a hairdresser's if I was going anywhere special. And then I'd look out and go, I can't leave. I can't leave because it's slightly misty out there.
Yeah.
I can remember in humidity in America once, somebody going, after I'd spent hours washing, blow drying and tonging my hair, and then she went, your hair's moving. So I've now got this cap of curls that I don't have to do anything with apart from keeping it short.
Well, I think of all the gadgets and the creams and the gels and the paste and the serums for the hair, it's like, no, don't need any of them. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I know. It's I really embrace that. Also, I chose not to wear a I've forgotten what you're called, the things you pop in your bra.
Prosthesis.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I never had a proper one done. I just used the old sponge one that they give you right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then I just remember being at work and I just was fed up with it all. And I threw it out. Never do this in a open office. Threw it out and threw it at my colleague Nina, and it bounced off her head, and it then hit on the man in finance department on the back of his head. Had to crawl to pick it up before he realised what had happened.
Sorry,
and then I did the same in a pub once. I don't know. I had too much to drink, and I just threw it at my daughter, and then it just went round the group. I just thought, you know, as I say, I don't. You know, because I'm flat-chested anyway, you hardly notice it. Yeah. But I don't know, I just felt, I can't be doing with it.
But it is funny how you kind of, you have to reinvent yourself. And going back to this again, an age being just a number, a little bird tells me that you're currently seeing a hot younger man.
No.
In the gym.
In the gym. Oh, my Fabian.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, so I go, he's got an outside, he's very hot. He's got an outside
gym. How hot?
Gym.
How hot?
I mean, I don't know if his husband would be
he's not listening,
if I
trust me.
Yeah, no. Fabian, he is wonderful. He has got an outside gym, which was really good during COVID. So I've been going to him, well, mostly every week, and then I did it on Zoom with COVID since I was, when I came out of the operations and the chemo and all of that. And I'd also seen a lot of, and you were talking about a lot. So when I first started watching and listening to you, you were saying a lot about exercise. And then finding out that now medically it's seen as being the fourth thing that you should be doing. You know, if you have the chemo, whether it's radiotherapy, operations, and the other one is exercise. So I was really, really inspired by that. So I say I've been going to him, and I've always been incredibly weedy. I mean, I was always the one that was never chosen. You know, sports.
Oh, yes.
You know, anything in sports, I used to hide in the toilet. I used to have a period every week until they totted it up. so awful. But now I'm thinking, you know, I can lift weights. I feel much stronger. I'm always going to hate doing cardio because I'm always sure I'm going to have a heart attack. And I'm going, Fabian, please let me off the bike. I'm dying. He doesn't. He's been amazing and made me feel so much better about myself. And he has the Underdog Gym. That's been brilliant. He's been
fantastic.
Would
you ever have thought you'd have had a personal trainer going into your 70s when you were younger?
Oh, my God, no. I mean, I can't imagine having a personal trainer at all. I mean, the thing is, it is for me, it's really important because I know, like so many people, I used to sign up for a gym every year, and then I wouldn't go, I'd feel a bit self-conscious or too
think
many
of all
big
the handbags you
there.
Could have bought with the money,
exactly. Yeah, oh my god,
or shoes,
well,
or holidays,
up a whole new thing.
Yeah, we won't go there.
So. And also, it's that whole idea of it being one-to-one, and also, I can't let him down.
No.
He's, you know, he's French, so he'll go, Mademoiselle, if I go for some reason, I can't come. So I can't leave him there.
No.
It'll be, what will he do without me?
And you've got to get your weekly fix. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously his favourite client.
Obviously.
Yeah, but he's really pushed me in a lovely way. He's always been so incredibly supportive. And then afterwards, he'll send me a little video of myself saying, look what you did. Look what you did today.
That's amazing.
And I'll be going, God, I look awful.
I need
to wear more makeup when I come down. How could you film me without my lipstick?
Oh, but you don't want lipstick when you're exercising because you just get hot and sweaty and you wipe it all over your face.
No, I don't. I'm the only person. He comes, when I go down there, he goes, why do you always look like you're just going out? There'll be other, somebody else will be coming out from his gym and they'll be wearing the whole gear.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a cashmere polo neck and some baggy trousers.
Okay.
Just can't get into the sports thing.
He's not working you hard enough if you're wearing cashmere to sweat in.
Yeah, so but then
have
I take
have words,
it off.
Debbie.
Take it off. But usually halfway on the bike, I'll go, I think I'm going to take it off now, Fabian.
Okay.
And I have a T-shirt underneath. Yeah, he despairs, absolutely despairs.
Oh, I love it. But again, it just goes to show the things you do when you're older that you'd never imagine doing when you were younger.
Yeah, and I think there's so much more information about it all now, and about particularly when you get older. I mean, I'm on, because it was a hormone-based breast cancer,
yeah.
I'm on letrozole. So I know that's stripping me of my estrogen, which I'm really happy about. So I know that that affects the bone. So every 6 months I have the infusion, bone infusion. But I also know that it's weight-bearing exercise that's good for that. So I would never have known that. You know, my mother would never have known that.
No.
Most people don't know that as you get older, if your bones are getting weaker, that it is the walking, you know, perhaps the running, the weight-bearing exercises, lifting weights. I mean, I had... when I first went to Fabian, I had my weights were 1 kilo and they were pink, and he didn't do an eye roll. He probably went out to laugh. And now I'm listing these. I can't remember what I'm doing at the moment, but, you know, I'm doing deadlifts and I'm doing all sorts of things.
But that was like me when I first started. I thought, oh, my God, I can only lift a kilo with my weak arm. But you build up. And it's amazing to think, put another 10 kilos on. I've got this.
Yeah. And other thing, I think that when you come out from breast cancer, or any cancer really, you're so worried about anything that might be bad for it. And what I found about your, particularly your Instagram lives, is that the information you give is so incredibly useful. I mean, so I am going to gush here, Liz. I'm afraid you're going to have to take it.
Okay.
So many of the things that you say, I've been worrying about or wondering about, or, you know, you Google it and you don't really get the right information, particularly about diet.
I'm
slightly concerned about the alcohol one, but everything else is good. But also things like, you know, I'm aware of the fact that you can get lymphedema when you've had your harvested lymph nodes.
Your nodes harvested,
A lot of the I found that things that were given out at the hospital, I actually had to ask for information. Mm. If I was going to knock it at all, and I've had the most wonderful treatment, and everyone from the surgeons, the doctors, the nurses have been incredible. But I will say that there's a lack of information. And so a lot of the information I got, I picked up from... you know, that Macmillan, the booklets that are outside.
Yeah.
But one thing I did feel is that when I asked about lymphedema, and I was given a little leaflet, and I'm not even sure if that might not be, well, you'd know, slightly out of date, because it was basically saying, you know, don't do weights, you know, don't pick up heavy things, and don't. So I was thinking, I just don't know whether I should be doing it or not. And that's when I started to see that you were also, you know, you were doing weight training, and there are other things around, I've forgotten the name of some of them, but other people that are doing, giving out amazing information on what you can. And most of the things you can do.
You can. And I think a lot of information is out of date, and often the hospitals they have to get rid of all the old leaflets before they can afford to get the new leaflets in. And it's and often you're not ready to take in information when you're diagnosed. It's really hard knowing what to give people and when.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm still, if there's one thing I still feel I need to get over a bit, is that anything that comes here from the NHS, Barry, my husband, always opens first. I've still got that triggering thing.
The fear. And it's actually horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, and also because I think I put an awful burden on him because there was a lag after the thymus operation. Mm-hmm. I didn't realise, but a letter had gone to my GP and also to me, and it was saying that they thought it was metastasized breast cancer. And for 2 weeks, he'd hung on to that before then went to see the consultant. It's probably a bit longer. Because he just couldn't, he'd told other people and he'd been very upset, but he didn't want to tell me. And I'm actually really glad he didn't, because that would have been a burden I certainly wasn't ready to carry for that time. But I have realised that it means, but then the other thing, I was on a work Zoom recently and I'd had a mammogram, I think 3 weeks before, and he suddenly burst into the Zoom and went, "It's clear. Aww. It's clear." So I said to the team, just to let you know, great news. My mammogram was clear.
And then make sure you go and get yours.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But talking about Instagram, you're also quite active on social media. And I love that more and more people as they get older are embracing it. And I love your avatar, by the way. On the whole, social media is a wonderful space. But have you ever had like online abuse or trolling? Or
the most recent one was when I went to Lovecrafts, when it was announced that there was, I think, 500, shall we just say, very disappointed people on on my Facebook. And it was great, actually, because I remember somebody rang from Lovecrafts twice in the day just to make sure I was okay. And it's that was really, really hard. And it was because it meant that it wasn't going to be wholesale again. I couldn't, there was no one who could do wholesale.
Yeah.
And also I really admired what Lovecrafts were doing as a company and their ethos. We're all called SKMs, which is smart, kind makers.
I like that.
Yeah. And kindness is a really important part of the company. And so I thought, yeah, this is going to be a good place to be. And that was awful because, you feel that you can't have a voice. You can't explain.
Yeah.
Because once you start doing that, you can get yourselves, it can be a black hole.
It's like you don't fuel the fire. Don't reply. But you want to. Yeah. You do. It's like a personal attack.
And it's awful. Understand. It's like being put on trial for something that you know isn't true. And I know that you've experienced it yourself. And the only way I can cope with it is to go, they don't know me, but it's still hard. It's still hard.
I try and feel sorry for them because their life has come to this. It makes them happy to put these comments on social media. And how sad they must be because this is what their life is about. And that kind of helps me a bit, but it is really hard to deal with.
Yeah, it's horrible. And I do exactly what you do. It took us time to do it because I just would feel so personally upset and wounded. But then you go, okay, well, and I do think this is one of the bad things about social media, because I think it gives a voice to people who probably imagine a life that we have that isn't like that.
Yeah.
And there was something that happened a few years ago, and it was, it's probably a story that I shouldn't even have had repeated to me. It was somebody who was, it was a psychotherapist. He happened to be a neighbour, and somebody had come in with feeling really depressed and low. And halfway through the sessions, she said that she discovered knitting, and she'd, it really changed her life. It just sounded wonderful. And then on the last session, said was really, really low again, and it's because she discovered me, Debbie Bliss, and I apparently lived on a ranch in California. I was very inspired by nature, and I would go out in the morning and wander around, and I just led this amazing life that she could never leave. And even though I think he probably shouldn't have, I don't know if it's like the fourth wall or whatever you call it, he probably shouldn't have stepped out of it, but he was able to cheer her up by saying that, I lived in East London. I was constantly stressed by work.
Yeah.
This wasn't the life that I had. And it did really cheer her up. But I do think that sometimes people imagine a life that you have. And it isn't like that at all.
No, it just isn't like that. A lot of us only share the highs and not the lows.
Mm, yeah,
it
yeah.
It can be very artificial.
Yeah, and we have a sort of a facade, I think, don't we? You know, people see that and they see our being positive and the energy we have and things like that. But don't see the anxiety. I mean, I've suffered with anxiety for years. It's only by getting older and by having to do the things I was scared of that it is feel the fear and do it anyway. I feel that so many of us feel that. And as you get older, I could never walk into a pub to meet a friend. Far too self-conscious. I'd hang about outside.
Really?
Now I just go, I'll just go up to the bar. Nobody cares. Who's going to care about an elderly woman sitting at the bar with a glass of wine? I found it incredibly freeing. And I found that, you know, what you were saying about, you know, style and things, I've just found my own personal style. It's just so relaxing. I've got my uniform. I know what suits me. And I know that, as you know, Liz, it's all about the glasses.
All about the glasses. I think it's kind of realising no one is looking at you because everyone is worried that everyone else is looking at them.
Yeah, it's that we all suffer from it. And I also think that one of the really great things that's happened about the last few years is that people talk about it too. I also find that as you get older, I can say to somebody, oh, I used to be like that. Oh, honestly, I used to be like that. Yeah. There are people that are perfectly happy to eat on their own and just have a book. I wouldn't have been able to do that. When I used to travel a lot and I was so miserable being in a hotel on my own, going and eating on my own.
Yeah.
And I could do that now.
I love it now.
Yeah.
I love going and sitting with a book and just having that uninterrupted me time. But is it age? Is it experience? You just kind of learn, I guess, to be comfortable with yourself. And
yeah. You know, sometimes I think this, I do see or hear this a lot from women. I would say I read it because it's usually in articles, read it, when they say what they hate about being older is being invisible. And I'm thinking, I think it's great. Mm-hmm. Once you've got your polar neck and your statement glasses, you can still be stylish.
I know.
You have your look.
Yes. I mean, take Iris Apfel. She is my glasses
icon. Oh, my God, yes. I love her. And the fact that the fashion world love her and the fact that people on social media love her, I think it's wonderful. And much older models being used, not just on the catwalk, older models being used on, in magazines.
Yeah, times are changing, aren't they?
Yeah. And it's something that we're really quite devoted to at Lovecrafts too, is the inclusivity.
Yeah.
Whether that comes from ages, diverse models in every way. It's wonderful because I think it's so important that people see themselves up there.
Yeah, exactly.
But also perhaps the best image of themselves they want to be.
Yeah, you need role models to aspire to think, wow, if they can do it, I can.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I love that the knitting world is taking this on. You take Tom Daly and his Willy Warmer pattern. Have you done that
yet? I know,
yet?
Bless him. I'm actually meeting him this week. I know, I'm very, very excited. Very excited about it. I mean, what's the amazing thing that he's done in terms of the image of knitting, because for years, if I was doing a radio interview, people would go, it was always men. I've always associated that with old people knitting. And I'd go, well, one, you can't see me and I am and I love it. But two, actually, that isn't true anyway, because there's this wonderful younger generation of people. But there was still that image there. And so to have Tom knitting at the Olympics.
Oh, fantastic. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Now, before I let you go, Debbie, I have one more question. I have a jar of joy for my listeners, and every week I ask them to tell me something that's made them smile so I can add it to the jar. And now it's your turn. What's brought you joy in the last week?
oh, do you know what? So when I did this presentation at Webbs, my daughter came out with me for a few days, and then we went on to New York, and then my son came and joined us. We did that for 4 days in New York, and then spent 2 days with lovely friends in mm-hmm. New Jersey. And I was going to do things. I was going to go to MoMA. I was going to do all the exhibitions and galleries. And I mean, they didn't want to go anyway. But what we did is we ate. We went to diners. We walked. We walked the High Line. We sat outside in the sunshine with a glass of wine. And I just thought, how lucky am I that I've still got kids, obviously, yeah. in their 30s, that I can have this time with, that aren't embarrassed to be with me.
Yeah.
I thought, I felt so completely privileged by that.
That's definitely going in the jar, Debbie. It really is all about spending time with family. And thank you so much for coming on Don't Ignore the Elephant.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you.
You too.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Don't Ignore the Elephant. Isn't Debbie inspirational? I had to stop my inner fangirl from squealing. As a fellow knitter, I've loved her patterns for years. She must be one of the coolest older women out there, and I'd love to think that she's given you hope if you're in a similar place. If you have been inspired to find your inner Debbie, please let me know. And for all the knitters out there, we have our very own elephant knitting pattern. It's designed by Claire Farrell, and all the profits go to the Institute of Cancer Research. The link is in the show notes with a discount code DITE for 20% off, and I can't wait to see the photos of all the finished toys. I have to say thank you for all your wonderful comments about Mum's episode. I've been an emotional wreck all week, and just knowing that she's been able to make you smile has meant everything. I'm loving all the Chip Butty posts as well. Definitely ketchup for the win. It's great to see the jar of joy is filling up, so keep sending in your entries for this week. Karen's was seeing her granddaughter wave at her from the school classroom when she went to pick her up. And Ruth said it was watching Friends for the gazillionth time. No matter how shit she's feeling, it always makes her laugh. I'm right there with you, Ruth. It's like comfort food, isn't it? Next week, I'm going to be speaking to Jazz Ampofar. She describes herself as having gone from broken to a brown Beyoncé. And if anyone can help you get out of a rut, Jazz can. I can't wait for you to hear it. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe so you don't miss next week's episode. You could even leave a review. I love reading them, and it brings me such joy to know that the podcast really is making a difference. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch up with you next week.